Well, good evening, good morning, or good afternoon. Simon, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Ferry. Yeah, all good here, actually. Britain is racing ahead with its vaccination program, and there's a kind of mood of optimism for a change, which is rather nice.
Well, that's good to hear. Well, you're ahead of the game, so that's also good to see.
Yep.
This time we've got Dan Graham as a guest from Gothic Storm. And there are also a lot of other labels that he produces, so we're going to talk about that. Hi, Dan. Great to have you on the show.
Yeah, great to be here. I've been enjoying listening to all the other episodes, and it's a fantastic resource, and it's great to be invited.
Thank you very much. Actually, we feel the same about all the information that you share on Facebook and the various groups, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that further. Can we start with just a little bit of background on how did you end up in the music industry, etc.?
Gosh, well, back in the mists of time, I was in a band which had a record deal with a Sony subsidiary for 2 or 3 years, and we had a bit of a run of minor success as a kind of an indie band in like 1999. Then we ended up being dropped, and I had to decide really should I in my own mind, I was taking a few years out from doing artificial intelligence. That's what I was going to... I was going to do a PhD in artificial intelligence. And I really just thought, right, the band's come to an end. Shall I try and do a career in music somehow, or shall I get into this? Shall I go back to university? And I really just Googled, how do you make a living out of music? And there was quite a few options, including library music, games music and stuff. And I just thought, right, okay, I'll try all of them. And then I thought, I'll just spend 2 months sending out as many demos as I can to as many people as possible. I'll start with library music because I just had an impression that that might be easier to get some responses. And really, that's as far as I got down my list, you know, because I managed to get a few jobs out of those first few demos. And they led to other jobs, and then I ended up doing quite well as a composer, and then finally used the royalties to set up Gothic Storm, and then gradually started adding new labels as I went along. So,
but did you know what library or production music was to begin with?
Gosh, you know what? I'd heard about library music. Basically, I was at some kind of course or something, and there was someone who was in a band. He was in The Farm. I think he was the drummer out of The Farm, the band. And he was saying he'd done some library music, and he explained a bit about what it was. And I thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. Because I'd always been curious about where on earth the background music comes from, and presumed it was some kind of, you know, like insider thing that people know about that I don't know about, you know. And so... yeah, because I knew what it was, I sort of Googled it, and I gradually just found out more about it by Googling, you know, and there was resources out there on forums and things like that, but it was still a bit of a hidden thing. I mean, this is around 2004, 2005, so it's not like there was a lot of resources, but you could find out by digging.
Yeah. So are you a multi-instrumentalist, Dan? Or, I mean, what's your instrument?
Really piano and keyboard.
Right.
And then
yeah.
I play bits of other instruments.
Yeah. And you still compose for the label, or are you exclusively publishing there?
I always intended to. I mean, the label was intended as my backup if the composing didn't work out. You know, I thought, oh, well, I could at least publish my own work if nobody else loved me.
Yeah.
But it just ended up taking over, and I realised I could only do it really well if I was focusing on it full time.
Yeah.
And it's just in the last 2 years I've been trying to claw some time back, and I'm trying to do 3 hours of composing a day now. But it's not actually for the label. It's a totally other thing. It's for a script for a musical thing that I'm working on.
So Gothic Storm is a trailer company, right? What made you find that particular niche? What made you zero in on that?
Gosh, it was when I was in the early years of writing the library music. It was just one of the companies that I was working for asked me if I could do trailer music, and I said, I don't know what's that, you know, and they sent me some examples, and I thought, oh yeah, that sounds good, yeah, like big epic stuff. And it's around 2005 2006, and so I did like an album of my version of what I thought trailer music was, and it was just, in my mind, it was just like a hilarious parody of epic music or something. And yeah, I got into that, and from that, I got a few other kind of trailer. Because I was still just struggling to get work from people, I'd be just sending out emails saying, yeah, I'm a trailer music composer. And I was just thinking, well, I did one album for one company. You know, I ended up getting quite a few jobs, and then some of the tracks that I'd done actually started getting used on trailers, and then it wasn't really a parody anymore. I was just composing trailer music. And because that had had quite a bit of a run of success, when it came to setting up my own company, I just thought, well, out of all the music I've done, the stuff that's had the best success has been the trailer music. So I'll focus on that because it's a niche. It's going to be maybe easier to promote by being a niche. It's also an area that I'm really interested in. I love recording live strings, and I wanted it to be full of live strings and choirs and stuff.
But trailer music is a real science, isn't it?
Well, it needs to follow certain formats for just purely practical reasons, just because it needs to follow the story structure of a trailer, really, you know, setting up some mystery, and it needs to be full of gaps, and that's just for the editors, so that it's easy for them to just insert dialogue into the gaps or swap from one track to another, so that, you know, they compile trailers out of several tracks often. Yeah, and it needs to end big and then get bigger. So, yeah.
So, Dan, is trailer music a genre of music, or is it a description of what the music does? I mean, there is the one particular type of music. There obviously is one particular type of music that is used mainly, but in your experience, are there other genres of music that are used perhaps to less extent, or is it always this kind of particular epic music that's used?
I mean, the simple answer is literally to just watch the latest trailers for the latest films and just see what they're using. And so in terms of what people actually use, it really varies. And it varies by genre of film. For example, comedies are going to be a lot more like hip-hop, pop, and like acoustic guitar grooves and things like that. And then thrillers, you know, it's going to be often more sound design. And then when it's the TV spot, they want everything to be kind of really big and really quick, so it doesn't have the long big build that you might get from a 3-minute trailer. So yeah, it's more just going in there with big sound design and big drums. And so and then sometimes they really want to go for something unusual and unexpected and that really stands out, so, you know, like really kind of ethereal choir music, or often it's it's trailerized versions of popular songs. And so, I mean, there's quite a wide range. But I suppose there is a genre that people think of as trailer music.
Most of the trailer music that I recognize and I listen to is very in your face epic. It's like over the top. It can't be louder than it is. Isn't that like a dead end road? Because how do you go bigger?
I don't suppose the purpose is exactly to keep trying to get bigger and bigger with every new album. It's really just by the end of a lot of tracks, you want that to be as big as any track can get. But in the last 10 seconds or 20 seconds. So I guess that's always a challenge to do that. But really, we're trying to always cover new ground with each album so that it's, you know, it's something unique. Like the album that we've just finished and we're just releasing today, it's called Dragon Rising. And it's basically Chinese-influenced music that's still very strongly Hollywood trailer music, but it's all East Asian composers bringing their experience to the table. But it's not traditional music, it's still big trailer music. It's just that it's got these influences in the harmonic structure, the melodies, and also some of the instruments. You know, and that's a unique album. And we did a gospel album that's like trailerized gospel last year, and that was an amazing gospel choir. So in other words, it's not like we're just trying to make every album just like epic and each one bigger than the last. I mean, you know, we're trying to sort of cover different areas, and often it's just a case of building an album concept around something that we know that we've got missing because people keep asking for it, and, you know.
And the music you produce is essentially really exciting, and obviously not just trailer editors use it, but you can listen to an episode of MasterChef and the guy walks from one bench to another and there's kind of amazingly dramatic music used because it's exciting, because it covers a gap in a production. I wondered how that affects what you're doing, that your kind of music is used for things that it's not designed to be used for, but it does pumps excitement into things that are essentially not very exciting. And it becomes, you know, it becomes... is it overused, or are you happy? Obviously, happy from a financial point of view, but from a point of view of aesthetic, I think Ferry's asking the same question I am: where does it go? You know, you've answered that to a certain extent, but it can't keep getting bigger and louder, can it? It has to kind of another aesthetic or something has to come in.
I mean, I think you know, it's like there's two different things. There's the idea of giant epic music,
yeah,
and then there's the idea of creating music for trailers, and there's an overlap, but they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
So the big epic music, that is something that we did kind of focus on a bit for the first 5 years between 2010 and 2015. So we do have a lot of that kind of stuff in the back catalogue. And then we did, even recently, we did an album that was really designed as our kind of parody trailer album, that was called, I've forgotten what it's called now. It's something like an epic choral, stabbing epic choral something or other. And the idea was that that kind of style of music had sort of gone out of fashion a few years ago in terms of actual trailers, but it's needed for kind of parody moments. It was actually Trailer House asking for something like that for a SpongeBob SquarePants. So it's almost like they wanted this, a parody of a big da-da. Yeah. So it's like, all right, well, let's go for it and, you know, revisit that sound, but with, you know, 2020 drums, and make it 10 times bigger than it even was when it was popular. So that kind of stuff gets used in parody type contexts, right, and MasterChef.
Reality TV, probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose that's more back catalogue stuff for us, really, yeah, apart from that one parody type album. And everything else, it's not designed on being bigger and bigger so much as covering specific types of scenario and emotion and countries, or,
yeah,
you know, dark thrillers. Or
I sometimes still look at old trailers, like from the movie in the 80s and stuff like that. And what's really funny, a lot of those always began with, in a world where, you know, it's like, and there was a voiceover explaining what the movie was about. Mm-hmm. And now that doesn't happen anymore, and the tempo is so much higher than it used to be.
Yeah, I think that was all one guy. There was just this trailer music guy who did all the voiceovers. Yeah. I think he died a few years ago. I think there's a whole film about that. I called it Inner World. But trailers, I suppose now, you're not really going to get voiceovers too much. And if you did, it'd be seen as a real nod to something, or maybe a parody or something. Because I suppose they try and tell the story with the visuals and the music now and the dialogue.
So if you use gospel choirs and choirs and strings, that must be very costly to record.
Yeah, well, you see, classically, It's a combination. It's initially there was a bit of money there because I was reinvesting money I'd earned as a composer, but I was trying to get the most expensive possible sound, but as cheaply as possible, while still sounding amazing. And so that involved a lot of recording quartets and, you know, multi-tracking them, and the same with choirs. I think our first choral album was one singer. Yeah, it was. That was a an opera singer that I that was busking in Liverpool, and I just sort of stopped and said, "Do you want to sing some trailer music?" And she was like, "Yeah, okay." So she was the choir on our first couple of albums. So it was really trying to kind of keep it affordable. But as now that we're doing better, I suppose we're just going back down the more traditional route of just big, big sections. So it is more expensive now, but it's worth it. I mean, it sounds great.
So, Dan, you're a traditional library in the sense that you use sub-publishers abroad, but I understand that you don't use a sub-publisher in America, is that right? Do you do your own deals with America? How does that work?
Yeah, gosh, well, for the first 5 years, we had a sub-publisher in America, and it just wasn't going very well. We were just not getting many placements, didn't really know why. And I went out there and met up with them and went to meet some of the trailer houses as a bit of an invited guest. And I just realised what the problem was, and that was just that they had 80 other catalogues.
Yeah.
One or two of them were trailer music and the others were just everything else on earth. And so it was obvious that even if they thought we were the best catalogue that they've ever met, they can't really devote an entire conversation to talking about our music. So I suppose it was obvious that we were just too much of a small fish in a big pond there. And so, well, we started going out more often just as kind of like guests and stuff. And then I ended up just sort of going out there on my own, meeting the trailer houses. But then this sub-publisher was sort of getting 50% of the income. We started to see quite a big increase in sales, but it was all... I mean, I don't want to take too much credit, but it seemed to be coming from my efforts. And so we thought, well, let's set up our own company there and just see how it goes. And we went down this whole path of Michael, who I work with now, and he's now based here. He effectively sort of emigrated to America. That was his plan. And we got a visa for him and he set up an office there. And then, well, he got, I think he got homesick. And he wanted to come back. And then we got someone local there. And it just, for different reasons, it didn't quite work out.
Yeah.
And so what we had a choice to make then, this was around about 3 or 4 years ago. It was like, well, what do we do? Should we try and find another sub-publisher? Should we try and hire someone else? And I just had this idea of like, what about if for like 6 months we do a test where me and my wife Sophie, who's also the co-owner of the company, what about if us two go out there and we just try and do it all directly, and instead of paying the salary of someone local, we just spend all that money on flights and hotels and just go out every 3 months and just see how that goes. And so we just did it as a test, really, but it went so well. It was just immediate, you know. Each time we'd come back and the cost of going was covered, you know, 4 or 5 times over. And then we started getting into the whole custom music thing. We started putting a plan together, and just through working much more closely and directly with all our contacts there, we were doing custom jobs, and then we were, I suppose, just because we were working much more closely with them directly, then they were thinking of us when it came to what music they needed. And we built up a whole search system where we've got a guy there, Wes, who's based over there, and he does these super fast searches for everybody. You know, and we're all doing it via an American company, which we own. And it just, I mean, sales are just, you can't compare, you know, what it is now to what it was. It's 10 times bigger than what it was 3 or 4 years ago.
So, do you think you would have been able to reach the same level of sales if you had been with a sub-publisher?
No, it'd have been absolutely impossible. There's just no way. Because I've never seen results like that from anyone. And it was just so obvious that it was just coming through direct. Building up good direct relationships with a very small number of people who've got, where the main client have got the most money in the world, I suppose you could say, like the major studios. So if you've got a really small number of clients and they're the people who pay the most money, it's a good ratio of effort to return, you might say.
So that obviously works because of Hollywood and the scale there. Does that, is that a business model that you've thought of applying in different territories, Dan, or is it so unique to America that's going to work?
I like the way that we're just doing this. I think some of it comes from the fact that because I'm running the whole thing and I know all the composers and I know the catalogue inside out, it means that when I'm talking to this very small number of clients, you know, I'm motivated and knowledgeable in a way that nobody else really could be. So yeah. I can't see how we could apply it elsewhere because I can't spread myself, you know, I can't go around just visiting, being our only salesperson. And maybe you could find incredibly well-motivated salespeople, but I think this works fine. I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
So it works fine for the States, but it wouldn't work for Australia or France or Germany?
No, I don't want to spend the whole... Well, after the pandemic, I don't want to spend my whole life just travelling, a travelling salesman. So it's not going to work for me, personally. I like going to LA, it's fantastic, but I'm sure it'd be great to visit everywhere, but the thought of just my entire life becoming a travelling salesman, it'd be hot, terrible.
Because one of the questions that we also ask here on a regular basis is benchmarking. If you have a label, you have a certain amount of albums, and you have a territory, how do you know whether the revenue that's coming out of the territory is good, bad, magnificent? Do you have any information on that, or can you share some thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I have done a few of these like analyses in the past where I've tried to look at what's the ratio between the population in the territory and the income from the territory, and then created a bit of a league table. And it's a bit rough and ready because you can get countries like, I don't know, India and Brazil, where you wouldn't really, it's got a very large population, but you wouldn't really expect much money. So, but even that's instructive because you would expect richer countries to produce more money per population. But it does show up differences between different territories. And you still can't quite tell whether it's the particular sub-publisher that's doing a good or bad job, or whether it's the territory that's difficult or not difficult. And things are also transitional. You know, sometimes it can be seeming to go bad, but then the next time they do really well. But yeah, you end up building up a bit of a picture, I suppose, of who's doing well and who's not doing well.
One of the points that one of our interviewees raised was that if a sub-publisher has their own label, they're less profitable than if they don't have their own label. So, you know, what a pure sub-publisher as opposed to somebody who's a mix of publishing and sub-publishing. Is that something you've noticed? Or, I mean, do you have sub-publishers who also have trailer labels and therefore you're kind of competing?
We don't have any sub-publishers that have got their own trailer labels. We've got sub-publishers that have got a few different trailer labels. Yeah.
That's a kind of level playing field, isn't it, in that case, Dan? But
yeah, it works well because it means people go to them for trailer music. So, and then, so I think, you know, that can go well.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, just a sort of sidebar question, Dan. What do you think the most, what's been the most useful piece of technology that's come around in the last 5 years?
Technology, for library.
For you as a person, as a creator, I noticed that you champion these kind of virtual headphones that place you in a studio or a virtual studio. I wonder if they're something that you think are really good or...
Yeah, that's a very recent addition. I'm wearing them now. The Slate VSX headphones, they're fantastic. It's by necessity I'm working with headphones on because I don't have access to the studio because of the lockdown. With the speakers, so when I saw some reviews of these mimicking different speakers and different environments, I thought, yeah, that sounds good, I'll give them a try. And I was initially a bit confused because it's strange when you get something new like that, your brain doesn't adjust, so it just sounded like slightly out of phase stereo or something, and it's weird, but after a few days It started to just sound like different environments. It's strange, but a lot of other people have said the same thing.
I think, obviously, the pandemic, the lockdowns caused us all to kind of re-evaluate our work methods and things. And it occurred to me a couple of days ago that one of the major technological differences is the fact that we have to record from home now, Dan. So, you know, whereas the whole curve of library seems to have been towards the one man and his computer, the new technology suddenly opens up to the possibility of as many people as you like, as long as they've got a reasonable mic system at home. And do you think this might be the opening of a new dawn where more musicians are used? There's lots of musicians who need work. It seems like some of the conditions are right there. You know, I've recorded something recently, the drummer was in Australia, the guitarist was in Wales, it's everywhere. And when it came together and you listened to it in the mastering room, you thought, how's that possible? You know, all these different mics, these different environments, and yet it sounded absolutely wonderful. I wonder what your take on all this. You're obviously using lots of musicians in studios in the good times, but now that's not available to you. So is this something that's opening a new door for you?
Yeah, well, right through the lockdown, we've been doing a bit of a combination of some of that kind of thing, like different string players overdubbing things. But we have had some live stuff going on as well. I mean, I don't know. We've got this. We use a lot of recordings in Vienna, and they've all doing social distancing and playing with masks on, and so that's still been ongoing. The only difference I'd say is that it does require more work trying to edit it and get the sound right, because. Yeah. The sound of a small, you know, a mono mic or a close mic in a, or even a stereo mic in a small room, it's always going to sound a bit weird, and it takes a lot of work to try and get it even close to a nice space with a bunch of people playing together, and you can't really quite get it. Although once it's blended in the mix, I suppose maybe you can't quite tell too much. But you know, the sound of an ensemble players all playing together, it still sounds a lot better.
Are there certain studios that are still on your wish list where you want to record?
I've never been too bothered about anything like that. To me, it's just the sound and I mean, I guess I'll just trust other people's opinions. If someone's organising a recording and they tell me, oh, you've got to use this studio, it sounds fantastic, and they send me an example and it sounds fantastic, then it's like, oh, great. But to me, it's just what it sounds like. I'm not really bothered. I know you get. Everyone seems to want to do a pilgrimage to Abbey Road and get the picture outside. But I don't know. I've got nothing against that. I'm sure it's great. But
that's not your thing.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure at least a part of me would think, wow, this is cool. Beatles played here.
Well, how about if it's not the studios, then how about the musicians? Because, you know, in London, if you ask somebody to double track, they'll charge you double. If you ask somebody in the Czech Republic to double track, they'll say, fine, no problem. Do you want me to triple track for no extra money? So is that, in order to get scale and size, do you find yourself gravitating more towards the musicians as opposed to the studios?
Doing stuff outside the, you know, because as you say, the musician union, they make it difficult to multi-track because you pay more than double, so yeah. It makes no sense. So it does force you to use people from abroad if you want to multi-track. And I mean, because it's just so happened that we've ended up recording these players in Vienna, and they don't have similar rules there, so they're happy to multi-track. But now we're recording with bigger sections, we don't really necessarily have to multi-track anyway. But I don't know. Maybe I should have more ambition. But to me, when you get a bunch of really what to me sounds like world-class players, and it's well recorded and it sounds good, I don't suppose I'm going to start going, oh yeah, but I want the Berliner Philharmonic, or I want, you know, Yehudi Menuhin, or I mean. I don't know, maybe I'm just, I always just judge it on how it sounds and what's needed for that recording. And so I suppose I'm not too starry about people's CVs.
It's very
CVs.
Pragmatic, of course. And the other thing is, like, I want to record in Abbey Road with the London Philharmonic or whatever. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
I think when you say, Dan, it's a reflection of how good worldwide musicians are nowadays. You know, I think you could go, I remember in my experience 20 years ago, watching a production get the music scored in Bulgaria or something, and it came back and it was all scoring an English country garden. It didn't sound like an English country garden. The playing just didn't sound particularly appropriate. But nowadays you could go there and you definitely get it, because the quality of musicianship is so much higher, the perception of what's required. So, you know, sorry, that's not a question, it's a statement. That's well, my experience, you know.
Yeah, it's true. I suppose they've learnt that they've got to be better sight readers, because I think that when I first went to Eastern Europe, going back, they had to spend a week rehearsing, because that's what they were familiar with. They worked for the state radio station or something, and they were used to being given 2 weeks or whatever to go away and rehearse the classical repertoire and then turn up. But instead, it was just they were getting stuff dropped on them at short notice, and they couldn't really sight read. So, well, I mean, they could sight read, but not in the way that a brilliant London or Hollywood orchestra can.
I just want to go back to something that you said before, Dan. You thought of getting a PhD in artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that was this weird. I mean, I actually did my degree in philosophy, but my final dissertation was all about artificial intelligence, and this was in 1993, so it was all about neural networks. So I was interested in going into that, yeah. But I mean, that's as far as I went. I got as far as getting a degree in it, but I didn't study it any further. I mean, I've followed it just as news stories and, you know, watched it come along, but I haven't actually delved into it.
Can you see any products that are out there right now which are AI, and you think, wow, that will be handy to use in my productions?
No, I'm sure there are, but I haven't, you know, I'm probably just like anyone. I'm busy getting on with what I'm getting on with, and if I see some news story or some review of something that looks cool, then I'll look into it, but I don't have any specific, you know, inside knowledge about any amazing thing going on.
Do you think that AI will be someday capable of composing great music?
Yeah, I'm sure it will. But I think that will coincide with AI also being better than human beings at everything else. So including, you know, managing companies and, you know, just literally everything. So I think the point at which AI composers are better than humans, they will be just better than us at everything, and therefore we'll have a totally different society to worry about. I don't think composers should exactly worry about AI taking their jobs, because it'll have probably taken everybody else's jobs at the same time or even before that. So it's a world that's going to be very odd. So,
and when AI takes over, then we don't have time to worry about composing great music, right?
What? Because we'll be having to fight them.
Well, we have to work for the AI computer.
Yeah. Well, who knows? We'll all be AI human hybrids maybe by then.
Yeah. So, one of the things we've discussed quite a bit is metadata, Dan, and that seems to be one area where AI might be able to play a part earlier than it would play a part in composing music. I sense that that's slightly kind of further ahead in the curve, if you like. Have you been approached by anybody on that front to improve your data with AI or anything?
Well, I've noticed just that in their blurb that Discord, I don't know if you use that much, we've just started experimenting with that.
Yeah.
As that's a kind of a platform for distributing music. They say that they've got an automatic AI metadata creator. I haven't tried it, so I've no idea.
Do you ever ask your composers to come up with metadata?
Only for sound design. And I suppose that's just because it's because the albums have 1,000 tracks in them. And And you know, it's to some extent more predictable what kind of things is going to be in that. But we do it in house effectively. Everything else.
Yeah. And I suppose, do you play a part in that yourself, Dan? Is that something you enjoy or not?
I used to write all the metadata when when Gothic Storm was just me.
Yeah.
Gradually, you know, that became one of the jobs that were given out to other people as we went, as we expanded. I used to quite enjoy it. I always thought it gave me an in-depth knowledge of our music by really listening through and trying to explain what each track's trying to do. And yeah, I quite liked it, but you know, it's so time consuming, and I've got so many other things to do that
it's mind numbing. I think metadata, that's the biggest problem that I have with metadata.
I disagree, like, Kerry. I love it. I think it's,
you love it.
I do. There's something about the using language. Yeah, I do. I enjoy it. I can't say I don't. You know, I mean, I do delegate some of it out, but I do still enjoy the process. And there's something about, you know, it uses a slightly different part of your brain, doesn't it? Sorry, you hate it, Ferry. You're going to send me all yours now, aren't you?
Exactly. I was already typing an email to you.
I mean, it does raise a question. Is our words the best way to describe music? And can you describe music? And I mean, I think I asked you, Dan, the question of, do you get your composers to submit metadata? Sometimes I think I would just like to force the composers to think a bit more about metadata and how it might... just help them. I mean, for instance, if you work as a commissioned composer, you get all the metadata first. That's the first thing you get. You get a conversation with a director and a set of metadata, and then you write to that. You know, you get a description of what the track needs to be, whereas with us, we write the track and then we get the description afterwards. So I think it's a big part of it, but I don't think necessarily words are the best way to help people find music. And I know Ferry's experimenting with new ways of attracting people to the right piece of music, and perhaps we all will be doing that in the future.
I always liked the descriptions on the albums. You know, you could actually see that people were sitting down with probably a glass of beer or a glass of wine and thinking of funny ways of describing the track. And in the old days, that drew me to a certain track, the funny description. But you don't have that.
Yeah, I remember that. And some companies, was it Video Helper, used to do very witty descriptions, but yeah, I kind of thought, oh, I can't do that. And I also, how's that going to read in 5 years' time? You know, is it going to have lost its humour? But it's good, isn't it? I still remember some of Video Helper's descriptions because they were so quirky. You know, it's interesting, isn't it?
Even if you're just trying to be practical with the descriptions, it can be hard to know exactly how to pitch it, because you realise that a track could be used on quite a few different things. And so you've got to be kind of a bit general. You can't be too specific. And I suppose, I don't know. I suppose you just want to try and make it speed up the job for the editor in the end, so that when they look at that, they just think, all right, it's that kind of track. But without it being too musical. And if you're just talking about what it is instead of what it's meant to express, then they're not going to understand that necessarily. So.
I'm always fascinated.
Go ahead, Simon.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, on I Like Music, you can look at the top 20 search terms of the week, and you know, uplifting is there every week, happy it's there every week, sad. It doesn't really go far off grid in the terms of, you know, you might get pandemic comes in and hopefully that's going to disappear at some point, but you know, it's not a great wide gene pool of descriptive terms that focus all that. So yeah, you, as a library, you know, you do have to kind of characterize your music so it stands out from the rest. And you're Gothic, so presumably do you use Gothic terms, or how Gothic do you get?
Well, I suppose, like, you know, epic and trailer are kind of in almost every track that we do. But yeah, I don't know. As you say, I think there needs to be better systems for helping people to find the best track.
Yeah.
But we do it. It's funny because, like, when we get search requests, because we've got so many tracks, then you end up effectively just being like an editor, just on your own site, just putting in keywords and trying to quickly find tracks. And it's interesting because doing that makes you realize how the mind of an editor is going to work. So, you know, you're immediately just looking for certain keywords that might be, you know, dark thriller or something. And then you might be looking for specific composers that you know that they're good at that kind of thing. So I'm sure editors get to know certain composers and start searching for them.
Yeah.
But usually from titles make a big difference as well, because usually you'd be glancing through titles and you think, oh, yeah, that sounds like that.
I was about to ask that. Do you notice that, like, certain titles or certain words in titles tend to generate more revenue? Like, positive in the title, the word positive, or uplifting? Apparently, if that's something people look for a lot at ILM.
Or Bitcoin?
Yeah, maybe.
That could be a good one.
Yeah, all I can say, sometimes I've looked at what's our biggest earning tracks and I've thought, oh yeah, I can see why that would be at the top, because it's an evocative title, but it's a bit general, but it also really captures something about how it sounds and how it could be used. And then when I've looked at the bottom titles, often they look just as good and I just think, oh well, I've got no idea.
What a waste of time, yeah. That would be a great job for AI.
Yeah.
To look for all the information on the titles that are doing really well. Because there must be something in there, maybe in the metadata, in combination with the title, BPMs or whatever.
Yeah, but then if everyone had the same software, then everyone would be just trying to use the same three words.
Well, that's very interesting, Dan, because, you know, on your Facebook pages, particularly on the composers one, I noticed that there's endless discussion about what the best string library is, and you think, are they all going to end up sounding the same, or how do you break out of the box if you're all using the particular string library, you know, and how important is that? I was looking up today, the Synclavier was first used in 1977, the Fairlight in 1979. And those had very good music instrument libraries. And we're now, 40-odd years on? And it must be just the final sort of percentage points that we're getting to refining these things. If you were to give advice to a composer just coming in, Dan, now, what would your advice be? Get all the greatest software or throw everything up in the air and try and be unique or something else?
You know, any two people with the same software are going to, unless they're copying the same person or each other, then they're going to sound different. So you bring into it your ability and your own particular sensibility. And so I don't think, I suppose, there are some people who write in a bit of a generic way, and that's not really a good thing generally. It's a bit like, this is much of a muchness. So when we get demos that sound really good but just generic, I tend to not respond to them. So, you know, you tend to be looking for someone who's got an interesting sound that you haven't quite heard before, or it sounds somehow more evolved than everybody else because it seems to have some kind of emotional underbelly or complex quality to it. And they could be using the same sounds, but just they're sort of better at what they do. So, because I suppose it's like films, and they're all using the same cameras or whatever, but it's, you know, it's quite different material.
I wanted to go to Simon's MasterChef. Everybody using salt, pepper, nutmeg, but the dishes don't taste the same, Simon.
No, that's true, Ferry. I wasn't trying to make a point, but really just get out of Dan what his kind of advice would be to younger composers, whether it's kind of essential that you get all the gear first, or whether it's essential that you evolve your composition skills.
It's kind of both, because you don't want the quality of your sounds to be so bad that it's getting in the way of how good you are, because like slightly old or the absolute cheapest libraries are going to, the instruments are not going to sound very realistic, for one thing. So if you're trying to do a great orchestral score, but then it just sounds like a cheap keyboard, and it's an impediment because you can't really listen to it, because all you're hearing is the bad sounds. So so you do, and the best libraries and the best plugins do sound better. So But then again, if someone's really great, they can probably get great results from a small amount of gear that they know really well. So,
Why is it, Dan, that a 19th century construct like the orchestra is still so popular in the 21st century? What is it about the orchestra that still grabs us? And what is it about tonal music that's still here? We're still using the same scales that Bach used and things, and yet, you know, we're not using the same toiletry products, for instance. You know, it's complete. Why has music sort of stayed in that particular groove?
I suppose it's a system was developed and discovered over a few hundred years that really gets amazing expressive results from highly trained people playing beautiful instruments in a way that they've really practiced building that together. And it's hard to know how you could really kind of, well, electronic music and everything else and rock music, that's its own thing. So it's not that orchestral music is the only good music out there, but it's hard to see how you could improve on orchestral music.
Do you ever write in different scales or different, do you ever write in 12 tone, for instance? And
I've never got into all that, but apart from just the expressive qualities of it, once you get outside the tonal system, then you're expressing something, I suppose. You're purposely saying, oh, here's something mysterious, here's something ethereal, or here's a complex mixed emotion because of the slightly, you know, added notes in the chords. And so they tend to have an expressive purpose, and I suppose the tonal thing expresses familiarity and so I suppose each scale expresses something different.
I ask this question quite a lot, but after the war, American film music was dominated by European serious composers who wrote in serial techniques and in quite non-tonal. And when you look back at old films, there's a period of really complex music being used, which evolved back into a much more simple state where we are now. Can you see that coming round again at times?
I suppose it's hard to say, because on some of those old films, I suppose the reason they didn't carry on doing it is that it can be a bit distracting. It can be a bit much. You know, it's like there's too much going on in the music, and then it's sort of distracting you a bit from the dialogue and the action. So I suppose it simplified music is playing a role of sitting in the background a bit and not jumping out. But there's always going to be. I mean, it's great when great film composers can squeeze in some complex elements, and you know, I love John Williams, and his Harry Potter things are just full of beautiful complex things, even though it's kind of modern film music.
Yeah,
I just want to ask you a different question, Dan. It's because we are ending the end of this podcast, and I'm very curious to ask you about all the things you do on Facebook. There are two Facebook groups that you started. There's one for publishers and there's one for composers.
Yep.
Can you give us a little bit more information about why you started that? Is it because you want to share information with people?
Well, gosh. It started with me just writing a series of articles for Sound on Sound magazine about library music. And then I thought, well, I've come this far, I could just turn this into a book. And I wrote this ebook called A Composer's Guide to Library Music. And that did quite well. And I eventually just got round to setting up a Facebook group just for that, for people who'd read that book. And it was such an easy thing to do, you know, because Facebook's always saying, do you want to start a group? And just one day I thought, yeah, okay, yes. And so I thought, well, there I go. Now I've started it, I better email everyone who's bought the book and say, come and join this group. And it very quickly grew. And I thought, oh, right, okay. So that's gone quite well. And eventually, after about a year or something, I thought, well, I could do a similar thing for publishers. I thought maybe no one will be interested, but I'll just do it. It'll take an hour. I'll do it. So I started that. And then a lot of people joined, and then it's become a kind of a popular discussion. Well, I don't know about popular, but it's certainly, you know, there's regular discussions about inside things going on. So it's almost like it's so easy to do, and it could be a good thing. So why not? You know,
what's a question that's been asked most often?
In which one for the composers?
For the composers.
Gosh, I mean, people go back to. I suppose you get a lot of people just getting into it, asking about who's the best publisher, and things like that, and then they'll sort of talk about terms in the contracts and say, does this look right? Or, and then people will weigh in and say, yeah, that's normal, or you're being ripped off, which is helpful for everybody.
I think, Dan, one thing I've noticed on the composers one is, how do you approach publishers with your music? You know, what's the correct approach? Do you send in 10 CDs of your entire catalogue or 3 of your best tracks? You know, I think, and I think there's some really good advice given there, because there isn't a single answer, is there? It's a sort of, I think one of your points you make is sometimes sending in a whole album is a good thing, because, you know, you've got a ready-made project there.
Yeah, I personally favour that, because if it just sounds great and it's ready to go, then you can just take it and release it. If it fills a gap, in a way that you wouldn't have done, if they'd have sent you one track, you wouldn't have contacted them necessarily and said, could you do a whole album of this? But if it's all finished and ready to go and it sounds fantastic, and then it's quite an easy thing. And part of the reason why I say that is that that's how I got my first few jobs as a composer. It was sending out like solo piano music, and I know everybody does that now, especially. But because it was all sounding good and it was ready to go, then it got immediate traction. So I just thought, oh, well, that's surely good advice for anybody. But I have heard other publishers say, oh, I don't want to be told what to do and release your album. I want to choose my composers. And I mean, that's all well and good for them, but if you're a composer and you haven't got a job, I think it's a good gambit. If it's good, if it stands out and it's excellent, and you can always send the same 10 tracks to 300 people.
Do people also want to know how much money they can make as a composer? Is that an important question for a lot of composers?
Yeah, I actually did I wouldn't quite call it research, because it wasn't rigorous scientifically or whatever, but I was just getting some information about the range of income, and it was really clear to me that there's a very, very big range of earnings. There's some people that are earning, like, if we're talking dollars, like $500 a year or less per album that they do. And there's some people earning $20,000-$30,000 a year.
You're talking about the composer share then?
The composer share, yeah. And that's per year per album. Now, obviously, those at the absolute top end are making a fantastic living. And those at the bottom end, it's only going to be like a part-time job, and you're going to be doomed to just like throwing out absolutely tons of music to try and get by on that kind of income. And then realistically, a lot of all the publishers generally just somewhere on that spectrum between, you know, earning a huge amount of money and almost nothing. And so the answer is, it depends how good you are. If you're amazing, like really amazing, and you're sending out demos that the first anybody who hears it just thinks, God, I've got to sign this, because this is better than everything else that we've got, you're not going to really have much trouble working your way up to the top quite quickly and then making a ton of money.
But could you establish an amount that you definitely should make per album to be a credible composer?
Well, I mean, there's credible in terms of just the quality of the music, and that's a separate thing to how much money you make. I think there's something in the range of sort of maybe in the range of $2,000 per year per album to $10,000 per year per album for composers. It's about the range of making a good living. below that is a bit more of a struggle, and above that you're doing very well.
But presumably there's a shelf life to albums, Dan, right? So that, you know, an album that you produced 20 years ago, whilst it still may get used, or is this not the case? It doesn't have the power, the financial power that an album that you release this week will have.
I suppose there must be some of that, but, you know, when I look back through our earnings as a publisher and then me as a writer, the old stuff is doing really just as well as the new stuff still. So it might be because I'm in this genre of, like, you know, orchestral music or something that's got a longer shelf life or something, but there's really, I haven't seen that effect.
Hmm. Interesting.
The older stuff's still paying the bills.
One of the Dan, I noticed you wrote something saying that you had made a lot of money from people illegally using your music on YouTube and collecting back end from that. Can you elaborate on that a bit? I don't necessarily tell us how much, but I mean, how does that work? And is that an argument for giving music away?
Well, it's right. We've got these. We've got 8 different labels. Each one tries to cover a little niche of some kind. And so it's only really the trailer labels that are making money from YouTube, and that's because they've got wide fan appeal.
Yeah.
And so because of that, they get spread very widely, I think probably on like BitTorrent-type sites and that kind of thing. So, and the scene is quite cool, and for game videos that they put up, and for just, you know, these motivational videos they put up where they put clips from films and with some epic music behind it. And so there's all these uses for kind of trailer type music, and they don't ask permission, they just put it up. And then what happens is that they get a copyright strike, and but instead of us asking to take it down, it just automatically gets advertising put on it. And yeah, I mean, it started off as just a bit of a sideline, but It's literally going on for maybe $100,000 a year now in terms of for the label. Well, actually, that's all our labels put together.
Yeah. Dan, are they downloading the tracks, or are they just copying them off, you know, the stereo bus?
I've got no idea. They're putting them on YouTube videos and using them in the background on things.
Because when you wrote this, I checked out with mine. I went back, I started looking through it, all the illegal downloads, and some of them, they're obviously just taking it off the headphone bus or something, because it's, and you think, oh, I wish you were using a better quality version of our music.
It's
amazing that you make money on something that's
is stolen,
being used illegally. It's been stolen.
Yeah.
It's good.
Well, I'm just trying to think, where would that sit amongst the sub-publishers? I think it'd make it one of our biggest territories. YouTube. So thank you, illegal pirates. I mean, you can't come. It's funny, isn't it? Because you can be really have a principled stance against piracy and all that. But then if it's actually making loads of money for you and the composers, because we split it 50-50, it's not as easy to get worked up about it.
And so how does that square with your own sort of ideas, Dan, when you kind of, on the one hand, you're trying to stop people stealing your music, on the other hand, you're kind of thinking, oh, why don't you steal it?
At least steal some more.
Yes.
I have to be honest, I've always been a bit of a, oh, I don't know, when I started out, honestly, I had absolutely no money, and the only software I had was pirate software for the first, you know, until I started earning some money. And then I gradually replaced everything, and I'm sure those companies got their money back many times over. And so maybe, you know, for that reason, I find it difficult to get too worked up about it. I felt like I had no choice, and so I personally respect anybody else who's in a similar situation. If they just can't afford it and it's their only way to get to know how the software works, then good for them.
But Dan, if you were not a private company, if you were a limited company with a board, the board might come to you and say, look, this illegal downloading is going extremely well. Why don't we just open the floodgates?
Yeah, well, in the end, people use it because they want to use it, and maybe just making it more available would take the fun away. Maybe they like sharing it, you know.
Okay, yeah.
In the background and... But maybe it would spread it more, yeah. Maybe that's what everyone should do. Just go, there you go, everyone. Use what you want.
We're almost at the end of the of almost an hour, so I think it's time to end this podcast. I want to thank you very much, Dan, for a great talk, great insights.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to be here.
I think it's positive ending, you know, that knowing that even when your music is being stolen, you can still make some money. That's, I think it's very positive, and I understand your feelings about that. I don't think people are doing it because they want to hurt you or your business. They probably use the music because they love the music and they want to use it showing them playing the games or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
good.
So why not?
Well, thank you very much, Dan, Simon. It was great
Dan,
to see you.
Dan, thanks very much. Really appreciate giving us some of your insights. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Great evening.
Bye.
Cheers, Matt.